had purchased what he thought was a Percocet pill through a seller that he interacted with on Snapchat. And for whatever reason, he wanted to try it again one more time on the 26th. And that was the pill that killed him.
It's becoming an all too common story. A young person buys a pill via social media that turns out to be 100% fentanyl. Laura Didier's 17-year-old son, Zach, was just experimenting with a couple of pills when he made this fatal mistake. Now Laura is turning her heartbreak into action through advocacy work and helping other parents who've lost children to fentanyl poisoning through the organization Song for Charlie.
You know, to raise awareness, to combat that stigma, to say, you know what, it's happening to families that you're on the sidelines with at the soccer game. It's happening to families whose child is at college on a scholarship.
Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today, Laura. And I wanted to express my sincere condolences for the loss of your 17-year-old son, Zach. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. I know you know how tremendously overwhelming it is to lose a child. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about that.
And Zach died in 2020. I'm a couple years ahead of you. And I have to say, on this grief journey, those first 2 years, I mean, I feel like I can handle things better now. I felt like year number two was really depression for me. Mm-hmm. And I just know that this journey is a little bit different for everybody, but it's so raw and fresh within the first couple of years, especially.
Absolutely. I had kept hearing from other parents that I've met along this journey who have lost kids, that the second year can be harder because that first year, you know, everybody's around you supporting you. They expect you to be sad. They you know, there's more grace maybe.
For sure.
You know, you get into that second year and, you know, it still is raw. I mean, it's like every morning you wake up and they die again, because every morning your conscious brain has to accept the fact that one of your children is no longer with you. And, but I'm really blessed because I do have a tremendous circle of support with friends and family. So I'm still extended tremendous grace, even into this second year.
I feel like the first year is shock. And I feel like the second year, that acceptance, like you talked about, does begin. And I feel like I'm at year four and I have accepted the fact that my daughter is dead and is not coming back, you know, and there's nothing I can do about it. Which, when they say time heals, I don't think that's accurate, but I do think time allows you to find that acceptance. And I just think that's the only thing that can do it. Like you can't force yourself. You have to kind of go through this process. Time doesn't heal, but time allows you that acceptance.
Yeah. And a grieving father that I know out here in California, I thought put it really well. And he said, you know, it's not that you heal or you get over it. You just get, your shoulders get stronger, you know, to bear the burden of the grief. And hopefully you've incorporated whatever types of healing, whether it's exercise or hikes with friends or whatever mechanisms that you need, meditation, you know, to put into your life. You know, hopefully you've gotten those things into your life to really support you through the grief.
And yes, it's healthy, acute. Healthy ways to go.
Yeah. Hopefully so. And I know that I saw in my first year of grieving that there were some unhealthy coping mechanisms when you're just in that acute phase, that I really had to be mindful about and say, no, I'm not going to go down that path. I have two other kids that need a healthy mom. And I've jumped into advocacy, you know, quite quickly. And, I want to be able to be, I don't know, just helpful to my fellow grieving moms and dads. And so I try to really be mindful about what I put around myself to help me in this grief.
You and I are very like-minded in that way, because I have always said I'm really living for these two other kids that I have, or actually three. I have a stepson too. So three other kids and my husband that I have to be healthy and go on for them. Mm-hmm. And then I take my grief and pour it into advocacy, because helping other people really helps me the most.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to go back and really talk about Zach, tell me, he was 17. He was your youngest child. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me about him.
He was such a great guy. I mean, everybody loved him. He was happy all of his life, really. I mean, he just had a really sunny disposition. He was easy to raise. He loved school. He loved his older siblings. He had a great relationship with his father and with me and with his grandparents. And he just, he loved school. So he was a really, really good student. He was a great writer. He loved music, and he taught himself how to play piano from pretty young. I mean, he was probably eight, maybe younger than eight, when he really like found this love of the piano and could play beautifully by the time he passed away. And he also loved athletics. So he really pushed himself as an athlete. In reading up on your daughter, I saw how much really in common our kids had. Zach also did the hurdles and really loved the hurdles. And I have some great shots of him and videos of him running the hurdles. So, but some of the things about him that I'm the most proud, you know, when you lose someone, it's beautiful when people will reach out to you to say how this person touched their life. And all of these young people that I knew and that I didn't know, you know, reached out to say, I was a classmate of Zach's, and he was always smiling in the hallway, and he was always trying to cheer people up if they were sad. Or I moved, you know, to Rockland and didn't know anybody, and he was the first person to reach out and welcome me into the school. And so he just, he had a giant heart. He was really bright. He was really talented. And he just, like, one of the things that just really, I'll never forget about him was that I just think really demonstrated his heart, was that whenever he would say, I love you, Mom, if I said, love you too, he would always correct me. He said, no, you have to say, I love you too. You have to say the whole sentence. You can't just say, love you too. And so I'm just, those types of little details, he really paid attention to. He was a special guy.
He sounds amazing. And I often think when I speak to groups, I show a poster of young people who have been poisoned by fentanyl. And I talk about all the lost potential, because I just think about what if they would have been able to live to fulfill their destiny here on this earth. You know, what could Zach have done with all those incredible talents?
I feel the same way. And that's the thing. Like, he was on this tremendous path. He was a senior. It was the lockdown. So that's a horrible situation for someone that's a thriving high school senior, kind of in that prime, you know, year of high school. And he'd set himself up for just this tremendous future. He had just submitted his application for the University of California system, which is very competitive. So, but he knew he had a really good chance. He was also working on his Eagle project for scouting. So he had a lot of really good, he was a well-rounded young man, and in addition to being a stellar student. So he knew he was really competitive for that. And so we were in that, you know, anticipating phase of life where you're launching them and you're thinking, wow, they've worked so hard. They're going to launch in this beautiful way, you know, and then it's just all severed, like, instantly, you know, and you're just left with this trauma. It really is a trauma, you know.
It is. Yes. 100%.
Completely unexpected. This was a brand new type of experimental thing with Zach. He encountered fentanyl so early on that we really didn't have the typical red flags that you might be looking for if your child was getting kind of off of this healthy path. And and we got all of his acceptance letters 3 months after he was killed, and his top choice UC was UCLA. And, you know, 3 months after he died, just a couple days after he would have turned 18, we got his acceptance letter to UCLA. And all that potential he missed out. It's like he laid the groundwork for this beautiful future that he never got to see.
I'm so sorry. Oh, breaks my heart. Just breaks my heart, Laura. What happened? How did he took a pill.
Yes, it was a pill. So we pieced obviously everything together after he passed away. We were able to get his phone unlocked and get it to the authorities right away, where they discovered that he had purchased what he thought was a Percocet pill through a seller that he interacted with on Snapchat. It was not someone he knew prior. It was just, you know, this transaction. We know it wasn't the very first pill he tried, but it was maybe the second or third. It was a really brand new situation for Zach. And so we really didn't have a chance. You know, the things that you tell parents to look for, the friend groups change, the grades slip, all those red flags. It was so early on. There was none of that for us. It just, the rug was pulled out from under. So we got this pill. On the 26th of December, 2020, he took it at, you know, after bedtime, and he died slumped over his desk. But there were no pills in his room. There was no injury to his body. So
it had to be such shock. Who discovered him?
His dad. He was with his dad at that time.
And it had to be such shock, because if you're not even suspecting that your kid is doing anything. Yeah. And your story is so similar to Sam's, who purchased, I talked to another parent, whose son purchased a pill off of Snapchat, like a menu, mm-hmm. you know, to, yeah. and got it delivered to his home. I don't know if that's how Zach got the pill.
Yeah. I know one transaction happened at a mall, at our local mall.
Sure.
But yeah, we really were so blindsided, and it was too late. I mean, obviously his dad started CPR. Our 23-year-old son called 911. The paramedics came, but it was, you know, they tried to work on him, but I'm sure the paramedics, as soon as they arrived,
right,
did that, you know, out of obligation, but I'm sure they knew right away that he was gone. He was blue. He was cold.
And it's just so incredible to me. And I think we need to stop calling them overdoses, because it's such a misnomer. It's definitely a poisoning. It's murder. It's drug-induced homicide. Now, yes, the person had to take whatever they thought they were getting, but, mm-hmm. you know, having no idea that they could die right with fentanyl. And was the pill 100% fentanyl in Zach's case?
Yeah, there was no Percocet in the pill. It was a completely counterfeit pill. And the amount of fentanyl obviously was lethal. And so in our county, tragically, in 2020, they were really seeing a sharp uptick in fentanyl deaths. Zach was the last death in 2020 for fentanyl. So because of this alarming trend, our county did look at it like a crime scene, and they did, you know, have all of us outside. When I arrived at the house, they'd already had pronounced him dead, and everybody was on the driveway when I got to the house. And Chris, his father, you know, just said, our baby is gone. My other two kids helped me up in the shock of it all. And they were doing their investigation, because, you know, there were no other drugs in his room. There were no pills. There was nothing in his room. There was no evidence of any drug use. There was no injury to his body. They ruled out self-harm immediately. But they said, we don't know exactly what it is, but the coroner said, we're going to suspect fentanyl because we're seeing this trend in our county. And I'm like, what is that? How could my kid get it? I knew nothing about counterfeit pills. I knew nothing about any, there was no awareness in our area at all. And so, you know, I said goodbye to my baby. They had, you know, they had to do an autopsy to rule out natural causes, because there were no drugs there. They ruled out anything natural and got the toxicology report back several weeks later to confirm fentanyl.
Yeah, I can relate. You know, I laid there with my daughter after she died, and then I drove behind the ambulance as they took her to the morgue for the autopsy. And I just don't think, unless you've been in our shoes, that anyone can really understand. I also think I suffer, I know, from PTSD because of that. Yeah. That scene plays over and over again in my mind, like the night you're talking about, you know, or the morning. Mm-hmm. It's just that scene of finding out your child has died, because it's so hard for your brain to register that this is fact. You know, that's why when we talk about acceptance, Mm-hmm. I just don't think this is not supposed to happen. And for mm-hmm. us with Emily, you know, we did have warning signs and we were in the process of working on an intervention. I just didn't know that we didn't have any time, right? We were 3 days away. And I just thought, well, we'll get to her and we'll get her into treatment. Mm-hmm. But with fentanyl, I always tell people, fentanyl is a game changer for everything yeah. here. You, first of all, you can't experiment. You can't try anything. And you don't have any time if you think someone has a problem, because the next time they use, you know.
It could be it. Exactly. Like, we know that Zach tried a pill. Of course, we found it out after we lost him on Christmas Eve. But that pill must not have had much fentanyl in it. All we observed on Christmas, he just seemed kind of more tired than normal. Like, it was not unusual for him to stay up late playing video games with his friends. They were in lockdown. They couldn't get together in person much. So they still weren't in school, you know, full time or anything. So it was not uncommon for these guys to get on, you know, Minecraft and be up, lose track of time. So it was not unusual for him to be, you know, kind of tired in the morning to get going. But by the end of Christmas Day, I was like, you know, he never really kind of fully perked up. You just see. So the drugs was not in my brain. He didn't have a, you know, history of drugs. And I thought, well, because he kept saying, no, mom, I'm fine. I just stayed up super late playing Minecraft. And it's like, okay. And I said, are you sure? You know, that's it. There's not. But in my mind, the only thing I thought, well, if he isn't being truthful, would maybe be marijuana. You know what I mean? Like, this is how naive I was.
Yeah, of course. No, of course. That's, I thought my daughter was using marijuana and Xanax. Yeah. That's what I thought she was using.
Yeah. And I, yeah. and so I thought, well, wow, you know, he's telling me everything's fine. Don't worry. I'm good. I'm good. And so then I had to work the next day on the 26th. So he was with his dad on the 26th and I was checking in with his dad, like, hey, does Zach seem more like, did he get a good night rest? Does he seem more himself today? And he's like, yeah, seems totally fine. You know, so whatever, he was fine on the 26th. And for whatever reason, he wanted to try it again one more time on the 26th. And that was the pill that killed him.
Do you think that he was just experimenting, or do you think that he was maybe self-medicating for something else, or what know, do you think it was? Or do you have any way of knowing? Maybe you have no way of knowing.
I obviously, with, you know, without asking him directly, I can only kind of speculate, but his yeah. best friend, who's been an just incredible young man. And, you know, when in the aftermath and I spoke with him and he, you know, was like, Zach was really happy. He was curious, you know, mm-hmm. And he had a lot of guilt because he knew that his buddy was curious but they knew about counterfeit pills, you know, that they could encounter something that could end their life immediately.
Right. Yeah. I think, like, in Emily's case, a friend knew that she was using heroin, and I didn't know this friend until after she died. Actually, now I've gotten to know this friend very well, but I know that friend feels incredible guilt for, I mean, I didn't even know her, but for not coming to me and saying, hey, she's doing this.
Yeah.
But and I think fentanyl, you know, if you didn't know about it as much in 2020, or I'm talking 2018, I kind of knew because I'd been doing a few stories on overdose and I'd heard of fentanyl. And, but I just think a lot of parents are really in the dark still to this day. I mean, we're doing all we can. And I know we're going to get to talking about your advocacy too, in just a minute. But I just think that whole idea that they can just go on social media and get it, is terrifying.
It really is. And that was another thing that I had no idea about. I had no idea how accessible it is to our kids, you know, and the lethality and the accessibility I was clueless about until Zach passed away. And when they said, we think we're going to find fentanyl in the toxicology report, as we were waiting for that report to come in, we dove into our research and found, you know, out what we could. But at that time, there still wasn't a lot of information, you know, out there as much as there is now, even, you know, a year and a half later. And we just decided, if they confirm fentanyl, because, you know, we were talking, neighbors were asking us, friends were asking us, what happened? Zach's an amazing kid. How's he gone? You know, and with Zach's friends, just like the horror in their eyes, like, what happened to our buddy? Like, how is he how's he just dead? You know, we realized this information gap was giant, just huge information gap. And that if it was confirmed that we were going to talk about it, that we were going to be, you know, public about it and get information into the schools, however we could, we do presentations for parents and teachers and students, community groups, Boy Scout, we're getting into some Boy Scout troops, you know, just because Zach really was like the boy next door. He really is kind of typifies what this new danger is, you know, that you can just be dabbling a little curious, whatever. And that could be it. It could end it all.
I always say that parents can no longer look at experimentation as a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. I think we all thought, oh, well, when I was young, I may have drank or I may have done this thing and I was fine. Yeah. It's just fentanyl is a complete game changer. Yeah. What about the social media companies? I mean, do you think, I know Snapchat has made a couple of attempts at doing a few things here and there, but do you think that they're doing enough?
Well, I mean, I think it takes time to do everything that needs to be done. I think there's always room for improvement, you know, for sure. But I think that they're pushing out a lot of awareness messaging, which I think is really good. So I want to, you know, I think that if companies are trying things, you know, we should give them credit for the things they're trying, but we also need to say, hey, there's still more to be done. And I just think we have, because of the way this problem is just so pervasive and so overwhelming, you know, we have to look at every angle for how to get the word out to kids like immediately.
And Zach was under 18. So, I mean, if you would have had the ability or know-how to monitor his social media, if you would have known the threat was out there and been able to, I think more parents maybe would monitor it if they had a way to do that. I know, I think there's like one program out there, but the social media companies don't necessarily make it easy.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think becomes really hard to navigate is that part of youth maturation is gaining autonomy as they earn it. And like right. Zach, he always made really good decisions. We knew all of his friends. We knew all of their parents. We have to give our kids autonomy and freedom as they earn it. And so it's a tough call between giving them the privacy they earn versus like, no, I can't let you have any privacy at all. Ever, ever, ever. Yeah. Kids can also find a way, around.
Sure, they find ways around. And right.
So it's hard. I just don't think there's any real complete, you know, easy answers. I mean, he was 6 months away from going to college, you know, so yes, he was a minor, but he was also not that far away from his 18th birthday where you're like, okay, we're going to extend, you know, your boundaries here because you've earned that, you know?
And so you go around now telling Zach's story to as many people as you can. Mm-hmm. What are you hoping to accomplish with that?
Well, what I'm hoping to accomplish is twofold. One, to really, well, actually it's more than twofold. I've probably lost count how many things I hope to accomplish with this, but one, to make sure parents understand the risks that I didn't, you know, to understand that this needs to be a part of every drug conversation that you have with your kids. It can't just, you know, we had the drug conversations we knew to have, you know, about alcohol, vaping, marijuana, edibles, things like that. You know, we didn't know that we needed to have a conversation about this proliferation of counterfeit pills and adulterated recreational drugs, and also that component of the accessibility on social media. So I just really want parents to understand that. I really want youth to understand that the days of experimentation relatively safely way are over.
I think also that kids are very comfortable taking pills. You know, they're maybe more comfortable doing that than smoking a joint or something like, you know, and so I think that's also a big factor that we have to teach them that all pills are not legal.
I just want it to be common knowledge. I want it to be like every kid in America knows. Of course, I would never take a pill that didn't come from my doctor or pharmacy because all those pills out there are fakes.
Yes.
To deceive us. And they're, you know, that, And I'm going to look out for myself and my friends. And that's just not something, you know, I'm going to try. And I mean, obviously also it's in other things, you know, adulterated, you know, recreational and hard drugs. But it seems like, especially when I'm talking to people who have lost youth children, that it, you know, anywhere from, you know, 13 to 18, predominantly it's the pills, like you say, because pills feel safer to them. You know, maybe they've even been prescribed Xanax for themselves or Percocet or Adderall or something, or they know people who have. So it's a recognizable trademark name, you know, and they feel like, well, that's a safe way to experiment. And right now it's actually the most dangerous way to experiment.
Yes, 100%. It's there's nothing safe about it. And mm-hmm. our kids all need that information. And you speak to a lot of groups, and you also work for the organization Song for Charlie.
Yes. So I got connected with the founders of Song for Charlie pretty early on, you know, when we did get confirmed fentanyl, and I volunteered time. And then in March started, you know, as a part-time member of the team. And in really the sole focus really is just this awareness piece, especially to the youth, especially to this demographic, middle school, high school, college, that has grown up with pills, that has grown up with social media, to just try to just bombard them, you know, with information through social media, PSAs and things like that, through putting together slide decks and curriculum that, you know, the schools can use, that parents like myself can use to go into schools and do assemblies and presentations and things like that.
Have you felt along the way any stigma?
Of course. Oh gosh. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget the first time our story was covered on the local news, and the anchor that covered it was then and remains such a compassionate, you know, champion of spreading awareness. But I made the mistake of looking at some of the comments and the things that people say.
On social media, you mean, under the story. Yeah.
It's horrific. It's horrific. And I took a minute, you know, to decide, like, do I want to continue on this path? Am I marring the memory of my child? Am I, you know, but I could hear him in my head say, "Mom, you know me. The people that were in my life know me. Don't listen to these people. Save as many kids like me as you can." You know,
I get that 100%, because obviously I'm a broadcast journalist who went public with my story, and I've seen all of those comments. And when they're, you know, directed to you and your child, you just think, how can you be so ignorant, really? And, you know, in Zach's case, he wasn't addicted. In my daughter's case, she was addicted. None of it really matters. What matters is we need to save lives, and we need the awareness and the education.
You know? Yeah. I mean, that's another reason that I wanted to go public, because I felt like stigma is such a roadblock to finding meaningful solutions. And I think that the more families that share their stories, and everybody's got to do what they're comfortable with. You know, I certainly don't fault families who are more private about it and don't want to be out there speaking. That everybody's got to grieve the way, you know, that works best for them. But I just really applaud those parents that do go forward and share their story to, you know, to raise awareness, to combat that stigma, to say, you know what, it's happening to families that you're on the sidelines with at the soccer game. It's happening to families whose child is at college on a scholarship. With fentanyl, there's no discrimination.
I'm convinced that Zach's story has already saved lives. Have you had kids come up and talk to you afterwards, after you speak to them?
And that's what propels me forward through all that noise, you know, of the stigma noise, is that we do have that happen, you know, where parents have come forward to say, my child, it opened up a conversation with my child, and they admitted that they had tried something off, you know, off of social media, or they were thinking about it, and it opened up a conversation that I didn't even know I needed to have, you know, with my child. And then friends of Zach's, you know, he should have been finishing up his first year at, you know, most likely UCLA. And I've had a young lady reach out to me and say, you know, I thought Zach and I were going to be at UCLA together, and I walk around campus and I feel his absence. And I tell everybody I know about him. I tell everybody I know his story. And that is, you know, you're a mom, how much that means, you know?
Yes. Yes. And just the fact that other college students are hearing what happened to him may lead to them making a different choice too.
That's the goal. And that's the hope. And I mean, I know, you know, obviously we can't save everybody in the advocacy work that we're doing, but I think, you know, I think there are some kids, I think Zach would fall into this category, that if they really were educated about the landscape now, you know, that maybe experimentation isn't something that they would do, you know, if they really understood what was out there.
Right. I know one of the other things you do is you talk to newly grieving families who've lost children in this way. What do you say to them?
Basically, I say to them, you're not alone. You have a safe space here. And I just try to make them understand that they can share anything they want with me, you know, that it's judgment free. It doesn't matter to me how their child came upon fentanyl, if it was an early experimenter like Zach or someone who had been struggling for years. That makes no difference to me. When people register or subscribe on Song for Charlie, they can select if they're a bereaved parent. And then I reach out to them, you know, and just let them know you're not alone. We're so sorry. Here are the resources that we can offer. We try to do Zooms a couple times a year, with family, bereaved family Zooms, where people can come together and share their stories. It's not therapy. None of us are therapists, but it's just to be in communion with each other. And I offer, if they prefer something one-on-one, I'll do that. And a lot, I think a lot more parents, with all this being more in the news, I think that there are a lot more parents that really want to become a part of advocacy, but aren't really sure how to start with that. And so I just kind of guide them through the resources that we have for free at Song for Charlie that they can use in their advocacy work. And it's gut-wrenching, you know, to hear the stories. Mm-hmm. To hear the stories.
Well, there's so many of us now. I mean, I feel like with nearly 107,000 people dying of overdose, putting that in air quotes, but mostly fentanyl poisoning. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many of us from all walks of life, all classes of society, all education levels. It doesn't really matter. And I also think when we talk about like the stigmatized death, and then I think so much judgment also falls upon, especially mothers. I have felt this over the last 4 years, like, mm-hmm. Oh, what kind of mother were you? Well, you were working, you weren't paying attention to your kids or what? I mean, just weird things like that. Yes. You know, and I honestly think it has nothing to do with our parenting.
Yeah.
But have you felt that or encountered that as well?
I have. I mean, fortunately, not within any circles of people who know me and knew Zach and knew how involved his father was in his life and I was in his life, his great relationship with his siblings, but absolutely. And I think what it is people want to believe, well, it could never happen to me because obviously that family screwed something up, you know?
Right. And obviously there's something wrong with you if that happened in your family.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's just this protection defense mechanism, but luckily I've encountered at least face to face. I don't encounter that face to face in these.
Oh, face to face. No, I've never encountered it face to face. Let's say most people aren't brave enough to say anything to your face that they will put on social media or wherever.
For sure. But yeah, I think people just really, truly still want to believe it can't happen to me. They must have screwed something up. And I think it's just so they, I don't know, don't want to have to deal with it or think about it or.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think you're right. So what has helped you most in your grief, you know, in dealing with the loss of Zach?
Probably, well, therapy for sure. I did for the first 6 to 8 months, I was seeing two therapists, you know, one that was more, you know, talking things out. And then I did EMDR therapy for
trauma. I know a lot of people that have done that have said, I haven't tried it myself, but that have said it really helped.
I found that it did. I did multiple sessions of the EMDR, and it just kind of helps with the acute pain and the trauma for your brain to process it in a, I don't know, more manageable way. I do feel like it helped a lot. In the very first couple of months, I did need to take a little bit of an anti-anxiety medication to help me sleep. I just took it to help me sleep because I would find sleep was hard in the first few months.
I did that too. I took a very little and sort of just weaned myself off of it, but I wouldn't have been able to sleep at all. You know,
I wasn't able to sleep. I wasn't. And my father basically called, it's like, give me the number for your doctor, you know, and called to say, and of course it was COVID time. So it was just a Zoom, which I was grateful for. I didn't have to go into the doctor. I just Zoomed with her. But I just really tried to be very mindful about my nutrition. I found I was numbing more with wine, you know, in the evenings.
Me too.
Yeah.
And I had to really watch out for that.
Yeah. Too. I really made a conscious decision to pull way back, nearly eliminate, because that's not a good combination, you know, with grief. I'm an athlete. I wasn't doing as much in the early phase of my grief with kind of taking care of, I was running a little, but I actually had qualified for the Boston Marathon before Zach passed away. And so when I found out that I got in for this past spring, I really latched onto that as something I could run in his honor and just really focus on healthy outlets. So that's really helped me in just my personal grief journey. I have friends who are tremendous in terms of getting me out. I find being outside helps me a lot. Being in nature helps me a lot.
Me too. Me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have a group of college roommates. We go hiking, we go camping, we, you know, kind of rough it, which I think really just, I don't know, gets you back to kind of, I don't know, your core. It's very there. That's really therapeutic for me. And I'm very close. I have really great friendships that carry me through, and my family is incredible. So all of that is, and then the advocacy helps me a lot too. Just feeling like I'm making a difference, hopefully in some small way, and being connected with other grieving parents is really helpful for me too.
I know you're making a difference. I know just by being on this podcast, even one person listens to it and then talks to their kid, or someone listens to it, recognizes something, you know, that they could help someone else, that will happen. Just by you speaking today. And so I know you spoke over and over again. And I think Zach and Emily's and so many other stories are truly making a difference for people when they hear that story of a real person who should be here right now, really should be here right now.
But for fentanyl, and you never know where you're planting seeds, you know, you never know. It could be years from now that someone reaches out to me to say the difference that Zach's story made. So I just hold on to that because a lot of times it's not tangible, it's not measurable, but it makes all the difference when people reach out and share how they've been touched or what maybe change in behavior they've made because of hearing the stories of our beautiful kids.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing Zach's story with me. And again, I am so sorry for the loss of that amazing kid of yours. And thank you for everything you're doing with advocacy work as well.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I'm so sorry that we both know this pain. I will continue to hold you in my heart. And is my mission now, really. You know, he was my baby and I just want to make a difference. I want, you know, to carry, this is what he would want. I firmly believe he would want us to make this kind of difference in his honor.
It's going to take all of us. It's going to take all of us grieving mothers to just call enough attention to this issue and this problem to create real change and save lives.
I agree. So thank you for all you're doing toward that goal.
Thank you for joining us. Check out the other episodes of the podcast and read my blog on our website, emilieshope.foundation. If you like what you're hearing, please consider giving us a positive review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage.